All right, everybody, welcome to another Options Discovery interview. We're back here again for another episode with Kevin Darby from CQG. So Kevin, can you please introduce yourself real quick and just give us a quick summary of your education and career background?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I'm Kevin Darby. I am Vice President of Execution Technologies at CQG. I also sort of chime in anytime there's anything options or trading algorithm related, and have been in the options space a really long time. Actually, I went to University of Illinois. I was a computer engineering major. However, I kind of got the job before I got the degree. So I left college when I was 19 to move to North Carolina to basically learn how to be an engineer and a quant for an options market making firm. And I spent, that was from 1999 to say 2011. After that, I spun out with a couple of partners, my own software company. And then a couple, 2.5 years ago, CQG actually purchased the assets of that software company. It was an algorithmic trading platform and I came along with it. And I have been happily at CQG ever since.
So that's really interesting. And so as the Vice President of Execution Technology, what are kind of your roles and or what kind of work do you do at CQG?
Sure. So I built basically an algorithmic trading sort of platform within CQG. So part of the technology that I came with had like a low latency spreading engine with it. And then over the last couple of years, myself and the team at CQG has added execution algorithms like VWAP, TWAP, arrival price, and you know, one maybe we'll talk about a little later, like a volatility algo, so you can trade options and volatility. So I spent about 80% of my time writing code, C++ and C#. And then the other 20 is, you know, helping the team out and, or maybe try to contribute to some of the other projects in CQG, like if I feel like it could be helpful.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting how you're talking about how you never, and you got the job before you got the degree. I know that's in terms of finance, that's almost a very non-traditional path. So were you very hands-on with code and things like that before you even got to university?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I wrote my first computer program when I was 9, but it was before really anybody had a computer. So I wrote it on paper. And then when we finally got computers in the school computer lab, I like, you know, went and tested out and debugged it. So yeah, I've always liked it. I've always liked, you know, tinkering with things. You know, it's just always been up. I always like doing math, anything with math and money, I love. So, you know, options and finance are perfect for me.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. How do you think that the transition's been from obviously when you started and the technology that was available now to the technology that you work with today?
Oh yeah, it's way different. I mean, when I started, I was a clerk on the SIBO floor. So everything was manual. It was like, you know, huge people throwing paper cards at me and I had to type them in, or you know, risk reports used to take like 20 minutes to run. And now all of that stuff is, you know, tick by tick. I mean, really, sort of through the, I don't know, 12 or 13 years we did Blue Capital, you know, you kind of saw the evolution of, you know, floor trading to electronic trading really sort of begin. And then, you know, here in the time since, you've sort of, I think, seen it really solidify. I mean, you know, obviously we're not going back, and obviously there are very few open outcry markets in the world right now. And, you know, that trend will probably continue.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. It's been very interesting to see the transition. And I know at John Lithium News, we have a lot of documentation from a lot of people and video interviews. I think potentially you've done that stuff for us before, correct?
I have. Yeah, I did one of these maybe a year ago. Yeah, I would say to add to that, I would say that we've seen more blockchain-y type stuff in the last couple of years. So perhaps that is, you know, another phase of the evolution of finance is sort of the decentralized or trustless model there. You know, that's really taken off and to the surprise of some people.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll get into that later because I know CQG has some cool blockchain stuff coming out. So one thing that we're working on today, or the topic for the episode today, is going to be a lot about options basics and mainly kind of getting to the Greeks. And I know before we got this interview set up, we had kind of worked on or you had sent me a Google Doc and I'd kind of based a lot of my questions off of it, which is a really great outline for today. So we're going to be going pretty in depth. So just to kind of kick off with some of the stuff we want to talk about, can you introduce the idea of a right versus an obligation when it comes to long and short positions for options?
Yeah, sure. So you got to remember that options are agreements. So traditionally, the longs have the rights and the shorts have the obligations and they get paid for them. So if you sell me an option, I pay you the money. then I get the option or the right to do something, either buy or sell on or before a specific date. And in exchange for that risk that you just took, you get my money right now. And, you know, there's a sort of a counterparty in between there called a clearing firm or broker, depending on how you're set up, that kind of makes sure that, you know, you have enough money in your account to uphold your end. And that, you know, that if something happens, that I get the money I deserve in the end. And so, yeah, so a call is a right to buy, a put's a right to sell. And if you're long a call, you have a right to buy something. If you're short a call, you have an obligation to sell it to not necessarily the person that bought it, but a person that bought it before you sold it.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting because it's kind of where options really deviate from a lot of other derivatives like futures, where with a futures contract, you have the obligation on both sides. Right. But for an options contract, you get that right to execute or the contract or to not exercise the contract.
That's a good point. And to add to that point, you know, you can make a future out of an option or a couple options. If you buy a call and sell a put, you're essentially long a future payoff wise.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's... Same tenor, same structure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super interesting. And, I think that's a really, good thing to keep in mind when we're looking at options. And so another thing that you had mentioned, on the document sent to me was, transfer risk. And so I want to talk about what is transfer risk and how is it defined in a more practical sense for options?
Sure. So options are great tools to transfer risk. For instance, puts are essentially insurance. If you have a lot of stock or you have a particular view, perhaps that stocks are going to go down, you would want to buy puts. And so puts are essentially portfolio insurance, is maybe the wrong word, insurance for a portfolio of stuff, whether it's equities or commodities or cryptos or interest rates. So puts are really an insurance contract. And if you trade puts around at different levels and different strikes, you're essentially transferring the risk of downside risk to this asset to, you know, whoever you're selling it to. Or whoever is selling it. And then calls the other way, they are kind of a instrument to either hedge yourself in an asset where upside risk is the catastrophe. So, you know, maybe in some of the energy markets, right, like we've seen over the last year, or in the rate markets, sometimes this happens, or specifically VIX. So calls are the puts for VIX, because when something bad happens, you know, VIX goes crazy. Calls are also a nice thing to sort of receive income on a portfolio that you have. So if you have, you know, a bunch of stock, it's usually a good idea to trade some of your infinite upside on your stock to get money now against the probability that the stock will, you know, go through your strike. So it's a very common strategy. It's a very good strategy called covered calls, and it's essentially monetizes a part of your upside. But it's not a very risky strategy because you don't mind getting exercised. The stock or the thing went up, you got taken out of it, but you did so at a profit and you receive some money, you know, in the interim for it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And we had a firm on a few weeks ago called Option Solutions, where they were able to take very high net worth investor portfolios of stocks and create a covered call strategy to kind of generate that income for them. So that's a really good point as well. So another thing that we're going to get into is talking about options as contingent claims. And this is something that you had mentioned in the outline that we had worked on. So can you talk about this and some of the theory behind options as well?
Sure. So a contingent claim means that you might have a claim to something in the future if a specific thing happened. And, you know, basically the idea of options had been around for, you know, kind of a while, but really the seminal, you know, valuation or point of valuation was the 1973 paper, The Pricing of Options and Corporate Liabilities by Fisher, Black, and Myron Schulz. And what they did was they said, okay, there's this thing, it's an option, it's worth something if a certain set of circumstances happen. So they really boiled it down to the math. And what they assumed was they made this little universe where the underlying, or the return of the underlying to be more exact, varies sort of in this concept called geometric Brownian motion. This is just, you know, basically to say that this thing varies according to a normal distribution. The log of this thing varies according to a normal distribution. And then they essentially created a differential equation that if you made these set of assumptions, then you have this differential equation and that this is how this thing must act or how it must move. And then they solved the differential equation with a very important sort of caveat that volatility during the time, you know, of the option is constant the whole time, which in real life is not true, but it's one of the assumptions that they made. And then the basic sort of elements of the solution to this equation is basically the probability that the asset for the call would go equal to or greater than your strike price. And then given that, here's the conditional part, that if that happened, the expected price of the asset, given that it is above the strike price. And so that's kind of a weird thing to conceptualize, but it's really important when you think about a contingent claim. So you have two things. You have, okay, what's the probability that, you know, my call is going to end up in the money? And then the second thing is, what is the expected value of the asset if that other first thing happened? And when you do that, when you kind of think about it like that, you realize the Black-Scholes equation is both simple and brilliant. You know, and most simple things are brilliant. Most brilliant things are maybe simple. So the idea here with a contingent claim is, when stuff happens, the present value of the thing moves around. And then that creates, you know, risks and benefits. And then, you know, we can talk about that in a second.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because Black-Scholes is definitely something you hear a lot when you're talking about options pricing. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, sure. Do you want me to go through the math, or did you just kind of talk about what the model is essentially doing?
Yeah, just more conceptually what the model is essentially doing.
Yeah. So really it's those two things. It looks at this return distribution. So Black-Scholes looked at, you know, it's not the price of the thing that is normally distributed. A long time ago in 1900, Bachelier essentially created a model that said the price of this thing is normally distributed, and that gave rise to a class of option models. Black-Scholes said that the return, or the log of, you know, essentially, you know, today over yesterday, is normally distributed. And once you do that, you can compute basically the probability that the thing ends up through a strike price on the upside. And then you can also then kind of use some tricks to figure out the thing, if it is above the strike price, that it is, that this is its expected value. And really the thing you have, the thing that lets you do that is this concept of volatility. So volatility is the primary unknown in the Black-Scholes equation. I mean, the factors you have underlying price, you have, you know, contract specific things like strike price, and you have, you know, expiration, whether or not they're dividends or not, and interest rate, which are all kind of like a known thing. But then you have this thing called volatility. And I like to think about volatility in terms of like gambling. So if I'm rolling a dice, a six-sided cube, and gambling on the outcome of the cube, I have a certain set of conditions that could obtain. So that's maybe a low volatility environment. A high volatility environment means that your die is a dodecahedron or a 12-sided cube. And so more stuff, more outcomes could happen at the end of the line. And so higher volatility means more price variance or more expected move during the time of the option. And that makes higher option values, and less makes less. So volatility is really the thing that you're trading when you're trading an option. It's really the thing you're thinking about when you're valuing an option. It's really the thing that options market makers, or people that provide liquidity in options, are thinking in. They're not really thinking in terms of price. They're thinking in terms of vol.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it's definitely something that we've had discussed on the show before, but I really like how you kind of describe that with the gambling argument, because it is a lot about how much variation in price you have, how many different outcomes. I think that's a really good connection there. So the next thing that we have to go over is talking about the Greeks. So this is something that is very important when understanding options and trading options. So can you talk about each of the Greeks and give a little bit of information about each one of them and some of the formulas that are associated with each term?
Sure. So, okay. Think of it like this. When an option is sold, the seller of the option actually creates the option. It's not like there's a huge pile of options over here, you know, and like you could go get them and then sell them. No, you're actually making this thing because you're making an agreement with your counterparty, even if you don't know who they are. So the primary sort of cost in the creation or replication of the option happens to be delta. And that was a big sort of invention of Black-Scholes, is they showed that, you know, in a constant volatility environment under a certain set of circumstances, that an options payoff could be essentially replicated by, you know, trading underlying stock and bonds. And so that underlying stock, the ratio of, you know, if you have a $1 move in the underlying, basically the delta is how many dollars that option moves. So usually it's from 0 to 100. And if I have a 50 delta call, the underlying moves up a dollar, the call is going to move up probably 50 cents, very close to it. So that's delta. It's the first derivative of the value of the option with respect to underlying. Its cousin, its tricky cousin, is called Gamma. They're mostly Greek letters, the big ones, but you know, we kind of ran out of Greek letters and made a whole bunch more. So next is Gamma, and that's how much delta changes due to a change in the underlying. So it's the derivative of delta with respect to the underlying, or the second derivative of value with respect to underlying. And the reason Gamma is there is you have to understand that the options themselves have convex payoffs. So, you know, from now till expiration, you're essentially agreeing to a convex payoff because of the Black-Scholes world. So delta first, gamma second. And then I like to talk about theta after gamma, because it's, if I buy an option, I am essentially buying gamma. I'm buying optionality. I have the rights to do some stuff. And, you know, if the thing moves around, I can probably make money. So if I'm buying an option, I'm buying gamma, and I like to have gamma, be long gamma, but I'm also short theta. So every day or every, you know, millisecond that I'm long an option, that value that I paid initially is sort of eroding. And if the option doesn't end up in the money, it's going to go to zero. And so the measure of that is called theta, and it's the first derivative of value with respect to time. And there's, you know, there's different quoting things. Some people quote it in years, but I always like to quote it in days. Another one is rho, and rho used to be kind of a boring guy, but lately rho's been a whole thing. So you have interest rate exposure because of that replication argument of Black-Scholes with a portfolio of stock and a portfolio of bonds. So, you know, you have during the tenor of your option, if interest rates move around, you know, rapidly, you will see P&L events, and that's rho. And if you wanted to hedge rho, you'd probably do it the interest rate derivative market. And that's, you know, a whole other thing about how you would do that. And then finally, vega is not a real Greek letter. Some people use kappa. We always use vega. And it's basically the first derivative of a price with respect to a 1 percentage point change in volatility, or 100 basis point change in volatility. And this is really, when you're looking at like a what I would call a risk report, it's one of these things that, you know, is kind of the real risk you're taking with options. So you can make a lot of these other risks go away, but it's hard to make vega go away. So what you do, you know, if you're trading a big options book, is make sure that you didn't have too much vega in a particular spot. But very simply, if you were long, you know, some calls, the calls had vega, at the money options have more vega than tail options. And if volatility went up, implied volatility went up, the value of your options would go up. And then there's other weird ones. There's charm, which is D delta, D time, and there's color, and there's vanna and volga. And, there's a ton of them because, you know, calculus is fun and we like doing derivatives, but those are the main ones. And those are the main risks that you take when you enter into an options contract.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. So can you talk about how traders think about these different risks and what they look for while trading options in a more practical sense as well?
Yeah. So it's all about the replication argument. It's all traders, at least, you know, market makers are coming at this from a very sort of mom and pop shop type of mentality, which is, okay, I'm going to sell or obtain this much risk, and I need to basically get paid a certain amount for this risk. So you'll always hear option traders talk about edge. So an option trader is going to want to sell or buy an option, you know, buy an option lower than or sell an option higher than their theoretical value. And, you know, the bigger that distance, the more edge there is in that trade, but considering the risks. So if I could make a trade that would maybe help my risk, maybe I'm short a bunch of vega and, you know, I can buy some options lower than my theoretical value, I'd probably be more inclined to buy them than I would to sell them at that point. So an options trader is looking at their risk sort of at a macro level. And then if I have to make trades to make my risk worse, I want to get paid for it. If I can make trades to make my risk better, I can do them at less edge. And, you know, and the main risk there is delta. So if you look at sort of how edge in the options market, it's always sort of proportional to the width of the primary cash market or the futures market. So, you know, E-mini options, after you make an options trade, you're going to have to make a futures trade. And, you know, how much slippage are you going to get on your futures? The distance between theoretical value and bidder offer is determined by that plus a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great explanation of it. And so kind of moving on to the next topic, because I think that was really great. So let's talk about a little bit about CQG. So you had some things that you wanted to share from CQG in particular. So can you speak about what's going on and some of the new goals or releases that are on the horizon?
Sure. So, you know, our job at CQG is to be on the forefront of, you know, fintech. It's what we all like doing. It's we've been doing it for 40 years. And, you know, I've been doing it there for about 2.5, and I hope to be doing it for many, many more years. So I think from an algo perspective, options are very cool. So we coming soon, there's a, in my algo platform, we have a volatility algo coming out. And so it would allow a user to say, okay, I want to buy the, you know, E-mini 4,000 call at a volatility level of 30%. And so what the algo would do is essentially take that 30%, run through this Black-Scholes that we just talked about, and essentially price the option based on the future. And allow the user to also then make the futures trade to do the option in a delta neutral fashion. That's coming out. We have a little extension there that's going to hit into the CME spread book as well, because if you can do an option, you can do an option for less edge if sort of the delta is covered for you as a market maker. So sometimes as a consumer, we can get our customers better pricing on options if we do them in the spread book. And you know, the whole thing for the algo stack at CQG is basically we want to facilitate the natural consumer of the contract. So there are funds and there are people who, you know, have covered, you know, want covered calls. These people want options and they just basically want to pay a fair price for it. So, you know, I usually think of things like a market maker, but for these algorithms, I tend to reverse it and think like a customer and try to reduce the market maker's edge as much as I can.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I think, can you speak a little bit about, you know, when it comes to you're talking about these algorithms for your customers and getting a fair price, what is the main customer base at CQG?
Excuse me, that's a good question. So we have all kinds of customers. We have market makers as customers. We have hedge funds as customers. We have producers as customers. So, you know, if you're a grain elevators, I mean, we have kind of an entire ecosystem, you know, bulge bracket banks. I mean, you name it. I mean, at CQG, if you trade a future, not even on our platform, chances are you're trading it through our pipes. So our customer base is super wide and super diverse. And for the algos though, those algos are meant to serve a subclass of all of our customers, which is basically the consumers of the contracts themselves. If I think about like a market maker, as a market maker, I don't ever want a position. I want to trade in and out. I want to make edge and I want to minimize my risk report, minimize my position. But there are plenty of natural consumers of options and futures, and our algo stack, you know, basically helps those, helps these people accumulate or liquidate those positions without like taking a total bath, basically been throwing market orders into the world.
Okay. Yeah. That's very interesting. I think it's also good to keep in mind, you know, the customer base that you're serving with these algorithms, because I just think the way that everything works together is very interesting. And CQG has always been such a big name. I know on a more personal note, doing the CME University Trading Competition, it was directly through CQG. So I've been able to get on the platform a little bit. I just think it's really cool. So I appreciate you giving that.
Next time use one of my algos and you'll...
Unfortunately, they disabled all the algos.
So oh, bummer. Okay.
But anyways, if they had them enabled, I would be like, I know the guy who worked on that. All right. So can you tell us a little bit more about some of the blockchain developments? I know we mentioned this a little bit earlier in the interview, but some of the new cool blockchain technology developments that are coming to CQG.
Yeah, sure. So as we saw in the recent press release, CQG has entered into a joint strategic investment with a company called Nuts Finance. And the two companies are essentially creating a blockchain research lab whose first product is yet to be announced. But myself and my colleague, Ben Sung, are running the joint strategic initiative from the CQG side, along with our colleagues, Terry Lam and Daniel Tang, on the Nuts Finance side. And basically what we're doing there is we are developing a set of technologies that through blockchain and DeFi sort of bridge the traditional finance, you know, through which we have been a part of, you know, since forever. And then the decentralized or the Web3 type finance that, you know, Daniel and Terry, you know, helped create. They've been doing this since 2018. So what we did from the CQG side was I built a volatility-based matching engine for options. And so it will allow options market makers to make markets in terms of volatility. So they don't have to do that last part where they convert it to price and send it to the exchange. They can basically send their vols to us, and then we can then turn that into price for them when customer orders come in. And we're going to do this in the blockchain space with the Optio research lab that I just mentioned. And we're going to do this in the OTC space for some popular options products as well, because, you know, it's a long sort of market maker belief that, you know, really what you're trading is the volatility. So why trade it in any other way? So we've developed this technology at CQG and together with Nuts Finance, and it's got some cool benefits. Market makers can transact in vols. And if you think about it, a blockchain-based smart contract that is an option, you know, there's no counterparty risk. If everything's fully collateralized and you and I trade an option on the Optio platform, you got a smart contract and I've got a smart contract, and it doesn't matter what happens. You know, you're at the end of the settlement period, you'll get paid what you're supposed to get paid, and I'll get paid what I'm supposed to get paid, based all on decentralized, trustless settlement mechanisms that happen on the blockchain. So that's my pitch for Optio.
Oh, no, that's really awesome. I think I would have never thought of, you know, bringing that smart contract blockchain element into it, so you can automatically convert the vol to price, so market makers can just think in terms that they've already been thinking in and not really have to do that last extra step. That's extremely interesting. I think that it really brings a whole new level of flexibility, especially to market makers when they're trading. So that's, it seems like it's going to be a big thing when it comes out. Is there an official release date for the platform itself, or is it just the press release is going to be, press release is already out, but.
Yeah, press releases out. We'll have another series of press releases. We've been very closely involved with the Starknet people, and that's the L2 rollup that the technology is based on. So you'll see some stuff from us, you know, jointly, you know, here in the next couple of weeks.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Before we close out, I just have a couple questions for you that I kind of ask every guest. They're a little bit more individualized, or they're more personal to you. So the first one is going to be, what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned while working in the derivatives industry, or just some advice that you'd want to pass along to someone that might be just getting started?
It's okay to be wrong. You have to make maybe I'm just bad like this, but like, unless I actually make a mistake, I never really learn anything. And so, you know, smart people sometimes, I think, don't want to be wrong because it makes them feel like they're not that smart. It's quite the contrary. Smart people need to learn how to make themselves smarter every day. And the only way you do that is you're wrong, you figure out why you're wrong, and then you figure out how to fix it.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's actually something we've never heard in terms of advice before. Just make those mistakes, make them hopefully as early as you can, so it doesn't become a bigger mistake later on.
Right. And the corollary to that is, if you learn how to make mistakes, then you also learn how to never give up, because you also understand that, you know, you might think it's going to only take, you know, be this long of a journey, but it's going to be a lot longer. And, you know, so that would be advice as well. So if you know that you have to make mistakes, that they're mandatory, then you also know that you cannot give up when you make those mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great advice. And so that's going to be it for today's interview. Really appreciate you taking the time to, speak to us today, and I think the viewers will definitely be happy. I think we covered a lot of information today, so it's great. Everyone that's watching this now, if you're watching the full interview, you can also stay tuned for the episode as well, where we'll have a little bit of an introduction and a little bit of a shorter interview. And if you're watching through to the full interview, we also have it available now as a podcast. So be sure to check out the podcast on johnlothiannews.com. Is there anything that you want to plug real quick before we close this out, Kevin?
No, I just like to say thanks, and, you know, we appreciate the opportunity to do this, and, you know, look for our CQG and Optio, you know, news, you know, in the coming months.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Kevin, and I will hopefully talk to you later. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Alex. Bye.
If you're hungry for more options content, make sure to subscribe to the JLN YouTube channel and check out our social media accounts. Be sure to check out our website, johnlothiannews.com, MarketsWiki, and the John Lothian newsletter for more content.